My dad and I were always very close. The night before my 6th birthday, he took me up Falkland Hill, which is one of the 3 big hills in the middle of Fife, to get out of my mum's way while she was icing the birthday cake. And I can still remember that summer's evening, going up Falkland Hill in the sort of dimming of the day, as it were, and the light and the views. You see across the Firth of Forth to Edinburgh and the Pentland Hills, Perthshire in the distance, plain of Fife laid out before you. We were very temperamentally similar, sort of impatient and quite stubborn. We spent most of my teens at war. We used to argue a lot about politics, and we used to argue about pretty much everything. In my 20s, we started to develop an adult relationship. That's one of those great transitions, that you start to see your parents as people and not just as your parents. My name is Val McDermid, and I'm a crime writer. My dad was a clever man, but he was also very emotionally intelligent. When I came out as a lesbian, he was completely relaxed about it. He never expressed any unhappiness or disquiet. He just took everything in his stride. My cousin's husband took it upon himself to educate me in classical music when I was in my late teens and early 20s. He gave me the Mozart Requiem for a birthday present. The first time I listened to it, it was just shockingly wonderful. It just carried me away, it hit me in the heart. The last couple of years of my dad's life, I was writing what became my first published novel, Report for Murder. When the book was accepted for publication, he was very proud and delighted about that. He'd seen the cover for the book, but never held the book in his hands, because he died actually 10 days before the book was published. He was playing a bowls tournament, and he got through to the finals, and he went out onto the green to play the final and collapsed with a massive heart attack. The funeral was a very emotional occasion. The crematorium was packed with people, and then we went back to the house with the family, and everybody wanted to talk about my dad, and I just reached the point where I just had enough of people. And I just ran out of the house and got into the car and drove up to Falkland Hill. I sat there looking across Fife with the Mozart Requiem on full blast. And thought about all he'd meant to me, and let the music just wash over me and through me. And it felt like not just a vehicle for my grief, it's that sort of in the midst of death we are in life almost. You haven't lost everything of them, because part of them lives on inside you.
Sometime in mid-July, 1791, Mozart was approached by a messenger, actually a lawyer, with a commission for a requiem. It's generally thought that Mozart didn't know who the commission came from, although we now know it was from a Count Franz Walsegg-Stupach, whose wife had died and who wanted to commemorate the first anniversary of her death. He may actually have intended to pass off Mozart's requiem as his own. Mozart would have jumped at the opportunity to write a piece that he knew could be so expressive, because he hadn't had a chance to write a piece like that, a piece that has a very special meaning. This is not like another concerto or another symphony, but a Mass for the Dead. I think that he would have welcomed the opportunity to say, I'm Mozart. Let me see what I can do. He was competitive, let's say.
My name is Athanasios Komianos. I'm a practicing hypnotherapist and regression therapist. I had this lady who had long-standing depression, and to help keep the trance going on, I used to employ binaural sounds, white noise. So the sound was working there. I was regressing her, and she was seeing some scenes from her unconscious. And then all of a sudden, the next CD came on the CD player, which happened to be the Requiem from Mozart. As the first notes start to appear, this lady goes crazy. She was really screaming for me to stop this music. She started to hit the chair and knock on everything she could. Please stop this thing. She became like an animal. And then she opens her eyes. That glare, that frozen look. She was piercing through my eyes. And then I realized that the person who is looking at me is not that person who walked in my room. Sometimes, some people, in very rare instances, have an attachment on them, which is a non-human entity of a dark nature. Some people would call them demons. And I always thought this is nonsense, and these things don't exist. Well, whenever I had suspicion that the person who has a lot of symptoms that did not go away, then I would let Requiem play again. And there you would have the same reaction again and again. All these cases, all these people suffering. And it seems that these entities hate harmony, hate symmetry, hate the beauty of this majestic melody, closer to the divine than anything else.
I think the Requiem is the single greatest piece of music ever written. Mozart's command over how to express something, how to say something. I'm always finding something new. I'm Cliff Eisen. I'm a professor of music at King's College London. I spent a lot of time looking at and thinking about and writing about the Requiem, in part because my own sense of what was happening in the piece seemed to run contrary to everything I was reading, and all of which said that the Requiem is a work of consolation. My own perception of the piece was that it's incredibly scary. Even at the very start, with the winds and the dark sounds and the bass going thump, bum, bum, I allowed myself to think of a funeral cortege and the cobblestone streets of Vienna. To hear the horses clopping down the street, pulling the hearse, steady, slow tread of this funeral cortege. Then you have the outburst of the trombones that had traditionally conjured up the end of the world. And the choir doesn't enter with everyone singing together, as if there is some kind of solidarity in the face of death. The chorus comes in one by one. Then Mozart brings in the strings. These huge octave leaps. I hate to say it, but the violins remind me of the shower scene in Psycho. So the whole opening gesture of the piece sets the scene of a funeral and then disrupts it. Some movements, of course, are obvious. Confutatus, the confusion and the horror of death, casting of the sinners into hell, women wailing. First, it was only performed in churches. Then it was performed in conservatories. The funeral services of notable people, Beethoven and Napoleon. So the piece had become that universal secular symbol of the hero and the death of the hero, of humanity and humanity's relationship with life and death.
When guns started to fire, 1992, my town, Sarajevo, became a battlefield. We was smashed down under the siege. Every day, shelling, grenades, people dying around you. We had no water permanently 1 year. We have no electricity. We had food only from the packages, humanitarian. The fighting was every day during all 4 years. It's one kind of a living hell. My name is Gordana Blažinović. I'm a musician of the Sarajevo Philharmonic Orchestra. Culture in the war is one of the most important things. Give us strength. Give us reason to live, reason to get on. Our manager got the idea to invite somebody who is famous to play with us Mozart Requiem. When conductor Zubin Mehta said yes, we was amazed. Maybe now in that time, all world listening to us and give us hope. It happened in the middle of the war and in the middle of the Sarajevo, the city hall, that was no roof. It was confusing and terrible and beautiful. Voices of the choir, for me, was voices of the people who have been killed. My tears was because of my cousin, Dragan Oshap, a young, very talented trombone player. He should play that concert with us, but had been killed 6 months before that, just because he walked main street in the middle of day. There's so many young lives. What is the waste? After this terrible war, one nationality against the other, in Sarajevo Philharmonic Orchestra we have Serbs, Muslims, Croatians, Czechs, Albanians, Slovenian. We have no misunderstanding. Just can you tell me why that terrible war happened?
If you look at a score of Mozart, it'll have the lower layers reinforcing each other, trombones and cellos and double basses, because it makes it strong and it's kind of to get the message across and to get that feeling of raw human emotion, which is aggression, it's fear, it's being scared of what we're going through that we don't understand. It's our clenched fist. I'm Felix, better known as one half of Basement Jacks. The album that we used Mozart's Requiem for was the Scars album. So the whole album was about we've all got scars and our wounds and our bruises make us who we are. And it's that experience that kind of makes us stronger and better as people. Also, we used to use Dia Zero for the beginning of a live show. When you're out in the world doing gigs, often the deep stuff is the hard stuff to get across to people. And actually, you can have a silent space and then you play some music. Immediately, the atmosphere has changed. With Mozart, the fact that that's not the obvious thing that you'd hear in a pop concert setting makes people, I hope, interested and intrigued. You're just standing there behind stage, waiting to go on, kind of listening to the music and experiencing it, to come into contact with our pain and our suffering and look at it and sit with it. Mozart's Requiem is the perfect piece of music to do that. It's part of the cycle of existence. And then our sampled version came in next. Maybe four or five of us went on with like monk's cloaks, and so you couldn't see our faces. Parts of my life were coming together. The nature of life and existence isn't just the material form of our bodies, it's the spirit that exists in that body. I feel that completely in the Requiem. It's as close as you can get to heaven in the world around, like it is from the divine.
There's been a lot of speculation as to why Mozart died prematurely at the age of 35. There seems to have been something going around that killed a larger proportion than usual of young men in their 20s and 30s. But no one will ever be sure exactly what happens. We only know that on the afternoon of his death, when his friends supposedly came to read through the Requiem with him, he had a relapse. His doctor was sent for, but his doctor was at the theater and wouldn't leave to treat Mozart until the show was over. And when he finally came, after several hours of Mozart suffering, he put cold compresses on Mozart, which sent Mozart into shock, from which he never recovered. Mozart only wrote 8 bars of the Lacrimosa. It's a telling place to stop, because it's all about sorrow and tears. And so it's poignant and it's touching that at what is perhaps the most poignant and touching moment in the whole of the Requiem, that's the moment where Mozart stopped. He stopped because he died. I don't like to be the spoiler, but it's probably not true. When Mozart wrote pieces, he would work his way through the piece in piecemeal fashion, come back later and fill in the blanks. So the whole of the first movement, except for a couple of notes, is completely finished by Mozart. Successively, for the rest of the score, basic elements are there, but less and less orchestration filled in.
When Mozart died, obviously Mrs. Mozart got in a bit of a twist, because the commission was for a lot of money. A lot of money. So she approached somebody she knew could probably do a good job, Josef Abeler. He was slow, that was the problem, and so he didn't get very far, and Mrs. Mozart got aggravated, I suppose, or maybe the whole team got a bit frustrated. So Süssmayr was roped in, but wasn't so skillful at replicating Mozart's way of composing. But I think actually he did a better job than a lot of people think. After all, quite honestly, I don't think audiences could tell where the joins are. I'm Michael Finnessy, and I write music. The circumstances of my having a serious go at doing a new completion of the Mozart Requiem were driven by the fact that Southampton University forces were going to do a performance of the Mozart, and they decided not to do the Süssmayr completion. So they said, could I do something alternative? And I decided that Mozart on the brink of death can somehow see forward. He can see all the composers who wrote liturgical music, inspired or not by his Requiem. The work time travels chronologically, so it begins in the Lacrimosa, extending Mozart's material in the way that Rossini might have done, with decorative, more flamboyant, luxuriant lines. It's a joyous encounter. Mozart is a synthesizer. He brings a lot of different things together, ideas from the past, and he's something of a conjurer when it comes to the magic box of tricks that composers can use to move their audience, to stir their audience, to terrify their audience. He would have seen it as an opportunity to express life after death, the ideal life with God. It's not an easy life because you're kind of putting yourself through the mill all the time. You have to stretch yourself to the absolute limits if you want to feel that you're doing the job properly. It was an enormous test of my religious convictions, my technical abilities. I'm actually at, I think, my best writing dots on paper because that's what I was put here to do, I think.
Eddie and I danced the Sugar Plum Pas de Deux for the first time here in Miami. I was 12 years old. I was always, you know, a little bit more nervous, but once we got on that stage, it was just like one. My name is Lisette Salgado Lucas, former dancer with the Royal Winnipeg Ballet and the Joffrey Ballet in New York. When I did see him at the International Ballet Competition in Jackson, Mississippi in 1989, he performed this ballet that he choreographed to Mozart's Requiem, his own work called Lacrimosa. There was a lot of intensity. He would do many reaches, body contractions, clinching of the hands, gorgeous leaps, at the same time letting go. You just felt the passion in it. His fight. It was just absolutely stunning. It was beautiful. He won the gold medal. When we were together in Chicago, I remember going down the escalator. We had just had dinner, and he said that he needed to talk to me. And I said, oh, of course, what's up? We were just talking, and he said, you know the solo that I danced at Jackson? I want to do a ballet that continues it. That's from the beginning to the end. You know, and that's when he started opening up about what he was going through with his diagnosis of HIV positive. It's like everything just kind of stopped. He had a whole life ahead of him still. Like, Eddie was 20, but he wasn't scared. He didn't show any of that. I think I was more scared. I remember going into his apartment. He had a skylight looking up into the Empire State Building. Really beautiful. He would have the music on. He would draw out the patterns that he wanted to do, and we would create the steps in his living room. He would say, okay, try to do this, go right behind me and bring it around. And so I would, and then it would just take it into another step. He loved the body to move. He liked that style. Moves and ripples, and everything is very big and beautiful. It would just like incredibly flow, you know. It was a beautiful time. It was also very hard because I didn't want him getting sick. We got very, very close. We shared a lot, you know, a friendship. I moved in with him. It was a one bedroom, but I had the sofa bed. We just got very, very, like, brother, sister. We just wanted to make this phenomenal, this ballet. We had five couples, and then the lead female, which was my role. The men started the ballet. They were on their shoulder with their legs straight up, and then Death carrying the soloist, which was Eddie's role, towards the light upstage. We premiered the ballet, and the main company wanted to do it as well at New York State Theater. We were like, this is fantastic. This is great. And that's when he got sick. You know, I would massage his legs because they would get very sore. So every night I'd massage him and say, come on, you're okay. You'll be fine. You know, he was struggling. Even though he never showed it, he performed it. I was one of the five couples. I think the music, there's so much grief in it. There's so much hope in it. It was his life. It was his story. Many stories of people going through HIV, about life, about doing something about it, about hope. It was all there in that ballet. In 1991, he was really holding on because we were performing it at the State Theater again. He got out of the hospital to come see us. He was in a wheelchair, and he came out for a curtain call. He didn't go up in the wheelchair. He definitely walked onto the stage. You know, he was very frail, but still the same beautiful smile, his eyes shining like he always did, those blue, beautiful, sparkly eyes. That was Eddie. He was just so proud to see his work and the applause coming in for him. On March 9th, he passed away. His family was all there. I was there by his bedside. And his last words to me was, Lizette, shine. Shine, it's your time. You have to shine.